Darling, thank you.
Welcome, Rabina. Thank you very much for being here.
Good. So we do our little prayer again. We've got our little prayer there. Have we got our prayer to put up? No?
Yep, it's coming.
Again, remembering what we're doing is we're programming. It's like practice. You know, practice just means you keep doing the same thing again and again until you get good at it. Well, that's all we're doing here. What we're trying, but what we're practicing is molding our mind into the mind of a Buddha. That means training our mind with thoughts, which eventually come experiences. It's really quite simple, the concept. But we've got to have confidence in it. We don't have confidence in it. We panic, you know. So just keep going. So we keep training our minds in these thoughts. We, you know, we're going to rely upon, until we're enlightened, we're going to rely upon the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And by all the virtuous karma from listening to these teachings, may we become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. That's what we're saying. So we say it two more times. Sangye chodan sokye chonam la chakipati chakni kyatsu chi dagi personam ki drola penche sangye drupa shok sangye chodan sokye chonam la jantu badu dagni kyatsu chi dagi chonyen ki personam ki drola penche sangye drupa shok. That's it. Okay, let's go. So, okay. So what we're doing is using Lama Zeb Rinpoche's book as a commentary on how to help your loved ones, including.
Rabina, you're muted. Sorry, I don't know what happened.
Okay, I muted myself during the prayers.
Okay.
So we're using Lama Zeb Rinpoche's book here, How to Help to Face Death Without Fear. It's implicitly to ourselves, obviously, but it's explicitly to help our loved ones. And as Rinpoche says, it's education we all need. You know, the doctors and nurses, their job is the body, our job is the mind, you know. This is the one. And we've got to think about it. Otherwise, we don't like to think about it. So we have to think about it. So we've been through how to live our lives in the framework of impermanence. We've been through all that. And we looked at all the background of what death is, what happens, all the technical side, both the 12 links of dependent arising and the 8 stages of death from the Vajrayana point of view. We need to become familiar with these, you know, so helpful. Technical explanations of what death is. It's so fascinating. And then we looked at all the practices Rinpoche's got, all the thousands of, you know, 87 precisely in the back, all numbered, but the things to do at different stages. And you do many of these practices at different stages. The whole book is described in chronological order. The months and weeks before, the days before, the hours before, at the time the breath stops, then during the 3 days while you've got the body there, ideally, and then when the mind leaves. And then on the 49 days after. So we can talk about that now. We've done all that. So the key thing, remember I said when I gave this manuscript, and when it's sort of fairly finished because I happened to edit it, and I gave it to a friend to look at, and she said, where's the chapter on grief? Because that's, of course, naturally in our modern world, that's the emphasis on us. Of course, we want grandma to look happy when she dies. It makes us feel better too, with respect. But we, you know, unless we're Christians or Muslim, we don't think of anything after that. And that's okay, better than nothing. At least confronting death now, facing death, you know, which is really good, making it part of, which is what it is putting it, factoring into life, you know, lessening the fear. So we talked a lot about that. Remember, you know, the logic of why we are fearful is because of attachment, because we cling to things as permanent, can't bear the thought of not having them. This is the main reason there's fear of death. And this is every being, because we've got this instinctively in our bones, because we've had countless lives and deaths, you know. Except we don't remember. So the whole book, the entire book, the whole purpose of the book is so at that time, the mouse, the ant, your grandma, that when the death process starts, and then at a certain period, in that period, before you even stop breathing, the certain conditions arise that the seed that is be the one that will determine your next life. And this is the point. And we understand karma. Everything the thing we think and do and say sees sow seeds in our mind. So we produce our future. We create our own future. We don't realize it, of course. We have to. So we need a virtuous karmic seed to be triggered at the time of death. Why? So that'll get us at least another decent human rebirth. So we can keep on moving on our spiritual practice. That's the ideal. So everything we're doing is to help that happen, to conditions to be conducive so that that can happen. That's it. It's a technical point. You know, that's it. It's very technical. And our job is to help that person be peaceful, because when you're peaceful, the mind can be virtuous. When the mind's freaking out, it naturally triggers delusions. So it will naturally trigger a negative seed, which will, you know, chuck the poor person into the lower realms. And we don't want that. That's the whole purpose of the book. And then even there's many things you can do after that, the 3 days and the 49 days, even after that. Rinpoche's got so much optimism. But there's always something you can do to help shift, you know. And of course, the more powerful the person is who's doing the work, like the lamas, the holy beings, the more likely these things are possible. So it's this handbook, basically. Education we all need. So the thing to do after the 49 days, so of course the person, okay, 49 days is this experience of the yogis, that that's how long, the longest that a person's mind will be in the intermediate state, this dream, it's like a dream state, it's a subtle mind, just the same as a dream state. But it's, and depending on the karma that was triggered when you died, that'll determine the character of your dream state. So you know yourself, you can have these nightmares. Well, you know, the mardo can be like a nightmare. Or if you've got virtuous karmic seed that was triggered, you know, the nirvana can be quite pleasant. But basically you're hanging about, waiting for your next mummy or daddy to hop into bed or whatever they do. It's going to be a worm or an ant. You won't be much waiting around, I promise. But if it was a human, you know, not so many humans, are there? So to get a decent human body with all the right conditions, we have to create the causes for that. That's what we do in our lifetime. Get all our ducks in a row. So when we die, everything just all happens according to our plan. You know, it's very practical. And the key one is, I said that when I edited this book, you know, really what began to strike me is that we are in charge. We are in charge. It's up to us to prepare. We just tend to think, oh, I'll be okay on the day. I'll be okay. I'm sure. What kind of rebirth do you want? Oh, whatever's best. We're just lazy, you know. We don't realize we're in charge. Just like, you know, as I said before, you don't say, oh, what? Where do you want to go for your holiday? Oh, whatever's best. As if someone's going to do it for you, for God's sake. No, you better do it. Buy your own ticket, decide where you're going. It's exactly like that. It sounds so strange to us. Even if we're good little Buddhists and we don't believe in a creator, we still think, oh, I'll be okay. Lama Zopa will take care of me. It's just laziness. We've got to create the cause. We've got to put the virtue seeds in the mind. We have to be confident. This is very powerful. It's like a wake-up call. It's very amazing. And then meanwhile, whether your death's in 60 years' time or tomorrow, you'll be ready, baby. And meanwhile, your life will be fun. You'll enjoy your life because you don't have any fear. You've got your plan all organized. So simple, so practical. So then, of course, the other one I mentioned, I did talk about the Pure Land, didn't I? Didn't I talk about Amitabha's Pure Land? And I read Lama Zopa's chapter, didn't I? Yes, I did. So that's your other option. But Lama Zopa did say to one of our friends, one of my nun friends, we're talking about Amitabha's, and Rinpoche talks about how that's only really the one that's available to ordinary people. But he said to another friend of mine, a nun, Rinpoche said, no, better for you to pray to go to Kacha Gakil, whatever it is. It's Vajrayogini's Pure Land. Rinpoche said, more bliss. So if you want to get more bliss, you better pray to go to Vajrayogini's Pure Land. You've got to work hard, though. You've got to realize emptiness. Lama Zopa said that Geshe Lama Khonchok lived in Vajrayogini's Pure Land. His mind was in Vajrayogini's Pure Land. And that's the thing, when you find your yidam, when you practice, you take empowerment, and eventually you take highest yoga empowerment, you find your yidam, your own meditation deity. And it's very interesting, because all these Buddhas are just manifestations of different either virtues that you want to accomplish, or the reverse side, the purified delusion. These deities are representations of these. So when you know your main delusion, you can recognize your yidam. It's really important to think that way. It's psychology. So, you know, if attachment is your main problem, we've all got all of them. We've all got attachment. We've all got anger. We've got all of them. But some aspect is one more than the other, you know. Pride is a very common one from up in the West. We don't recognize this. We don't think this. It's very curious. We don't like to think we've got pride. We love to think we've got low self-esteem. But the shocking thing is that low self-esteem is deflated pride. If you didn't have arrogance and pride, you would not have low self-esteem. But look at the main disease in the West, low self-esteem. We love it. We swim in it. We think it's a virtue to think that we're a creep, you know. But the problem is pride. So how do you know what your main delusion is? It's kind of curious. It seems a bit simplistic, but think about it. The main ones really, you know, anger, jealousy, attachment, arrogance. These four, I think you could say. Ignorance, we've all got all of them, but we've all got different shapes and sizes, all different, you know, aspects of them. So if you suffer mainly from anger, you can tell. Even your face will even look like you've got this kind of, you know, like this kind of dark look, you know. And I mean, everyone gets angry, but if it's your main delusion, it's a very particular one. You have this very heavy energy, you know. But these deities, you can transform it. That's what's marvelous about Tantra. Many deities are transformations of purified anger. They'd be your deity, you know. If you've got attachment, I mean, everybody's got it, but if it's your main one, you suffer in a very particular way. You mightn't be so arrogant. You mightn't be so angry. That would be true. But you suffer, your mind go up and down like a yo-yo. Always wanting something more, always excited about this, always excited about that. Then I'll go have this one, now have that one. Up and down like a yo-yo, you know. Attachment's your main problem, let's say. Pride is really a simple way to say, if your pride is your main delusion, that you're very, when you're really injured, you're so offended when people, you know, you get offended easily. If you get offended easily by people, pride is your main problem, baby. And you look how we feel. We have that one, every one of us, you know. We're so offended. People insult us. When you suffer so badly in your life from being insulted or offended or not appreciated, that's pride. But what's interesting, it comes along, it's like a cousin, it's like a twin with anger. Atisha said, and I never know which order, either way it would work, the best humility is patience. But he probably said the best patience is humility. Think about that. It's so marvelous, you know. But again, our problem with these words, because we don't think like this in our modern psychological systems, these sound like morality, and we don't like that. We get nervous, you know. It sounds like bad and good. We don't like that. But think of it. Think of what this is, and this is something now. It's a very interesting talk. This is an incredible point about Buddhist psychology. The Buddha doesn't strike us until we really study it and hear it, that he distinguishes between the neuroses and the virtues. And the point is, never forget this. This is so clear. When we understand the very meaning of the word Buddha, the etymology of the word Buddha is very tasty. Buddha or Sang, Sangye in Tibetan, the first syllable, implies the utter eradication from your mind of all delusions. This is something we discussed yesterday. It doesn't exist in our culture. This is like serious mental illness to think that you can rid your mind. No, we discussed it. It wasn't here. We discussed it yesterday, like in the Brisbane talk. We gave a talk yesterday in Brisbane. And we had to talk about the mind. This is shocking, you know. We don't, in our culture, we give equal status to anger, jealousy, depression, anxiety, paranoia, love, compassion, kindness. It's a question of degree, isn't it? But there's no view in modern psychology. And this is a serious point. There's no view that says you can rid the mind utterly of all delusions. It's a demented idea. So many of the things that we think in the West, you know, we think, anyway, this is shocking. We've got to really think about this. So Buddha implies that. Da implies the development of perfection of all your goodness. That's Buddha. So clearly, if that's what you're going to end up, a person with only virtues and no delusions, then that implies the methodology, doesn't it? It's very clear. That's your job of being a Buddhist. So simple. We don't hear it properly. We complicate it. So all the deities, all the Buddhas in Tantra are just manifestations of these different qualities, and we've got to find the one that suits us. It's totally psychology. So we confuse these things. Like we discussed, you confuse love and attachment. That's a major one when you come to death. You know, we think when your grandma's touching her cat and stroking her cat and kissing her cat, oh, grandma loves the cat. Sure, she loves it, but she's totally attached. Don't be surprised she gets born as a cat next life. So get the cat out of the room. We confuse them. We confuse totally self-confidence. We could use that term, self-confidence and arrogance. Because we don't distinguish between a virtuous state of mind and a non-virtuous. The non-virtuous ones are neurotic in their nature. They're deluded, they're I-based, they're fear-based, they're ridiculous. They're horrible. We really could recognize them. We'd be so shocked at how much pain they are, but we're so used to them. But self-confidence is a valid state of mind. We need it. If you look at the Dalai Lama, I find him such a good example. When we think about you being humble, you've got to be a Buddha, you've got to be humble. We kind of imagine a person kind of walking around looking pathetic. Look at the Dalai Lama, for God's sake. He's the most charismatic, powerful person you could imagine. Then you go, oh, how can that be humble? Because we've got this wrong view about humility. We completely conflate self-confidence and pride, and then we conflate low self-esteem and humility. Humility is like a dirty word for us because we don't distinguish, because we don't understand this specific view in the Buddhist view that some have got the I-based, fear-based, neurotic, self-obsessed, the not neurotic ones, and then the others are other-based, reasonable, valid, appropriate, rooted in dependent arising. They're the valid states of mind. The other thing is, which is, like I said, very depressing for us initially, we never think we've got arrogance. But we've got low self-esteem. We love to confess to low self-esteem. Well, what does that mean? Because you're so injured, so painful. I'm nothing. I'm nobody. And when this one person looks wrong at you, it's like you've been destroyed. That's because we have pride. In other words, when we walk around with low self-esteem, the rest of the world, we think they're better than us. And we are really resentful. How dare they be better than me? That's low self-esteem. But we'll look at humility, completely different. Humility is a virtue. It's spacious. And the person who's humble is a person who's self-confident. This is a fact. Dalai Lama is the most humble person in the universe, but he's charismatic and powerful. So a humble person delights in other people who are better than they are. A low self-esteem person is resentful because we would rather be the one who's important. How dare they be more? When you're low self-esteem, you think the whole world is more happy than you. Look at all these rich people. Look at all these happy people. You know, if you haven't got a partner, a person who hasn't got a partner and wants one sees the entire world full of happy partners. I mean, it talks about our nonsense, you know. So low self-esteem is the flip side. And because all delusions have this particular function of exaggerating, of embellishing. So arrogance embellishes your good qualities. And low self-esteem embellishes your bad ones. They're both neurotic. They're fragile and neurotic and painful. But confidence, self-confidence, you would get that naturally as you get less attached, less angry, less jealous. And humility is a comfortable, happy mind that's delighted in other people being better than you. You're comfortable because you're not threatened. It was so important. This fundamental point is in Buddhist psychology, which is unique to Buddhist psychology, that there's a distinction between the neurotic states of mind and the virtues, and that we can eventually rid the mind utterly. This is what a Buddha is, of the neuroses. This is an incredible, outrageous concept. Nothing like it in modern psychology. Very fascinating. So you've got to recognize you're dumb. And you make aspirations. You don't know yet. You pray. May I recognize my yidam? May I recognize the Buddha that is the one that is most beneficial for me to practice, which is the one in this life, is the one that I am, that I want to become, you know? So you can be a nice little quiet little female person and maybe, you know, Yamantaka, this wrathful dude who'd scare the life out of you if you met him in a human form. Maybe that's your main yidam. You can be a big, fat, 6'6", you know, muscled man, and maybe Tara is your person. So whether you're female or male doesn't have anything to do with it. You've got to know your nature. Whichever is yours in this life. Geshe Lama Khonsa was this tall, wrathful dude, and he was Vajrayogini, this gorgeous, naked red lady, you know? So you've got to know your nature, understand your delusions, and then you get the practice that is most suitable to you. We need all of them. We need to practice all of them, but we focus on one. That's the one who you are. And some people recognize immediately. Some people, their lamas tell them, you know? But if you know your own mind, then you'll recognize. Make aspirations. Some people need to recognize immediately. They just know that Vajrayogini is their person, you know. And the only way to know it is know your own mind. Tantra is totally psychology. If there's anything in Buddhism that isn't psychological, finally, it's a load of rubbish. Chuck it out, you know. So important. Okay, I don't know why I started talking about that. Let's get to now the final bit. About what part 5, practices to do after the mind has left the body. So all the bits before, you know, what to do the months and weeks before death, what to do the hours and days after the breath has stopped, at the time of the breath stops, after the breath has stopped, and then once the mind has left, there's still plenty you can do. So you know how to prepare your loved one's body for cremation or burial. We'll go into that one. We'll look at that. What to do as soon as the breath stops, we did all that. We did all the scenarios. Your loved one dies at home, loved one dies in hospital, loved one gives the organs, loved one dies suddenly, loved one is a yogi. There's different scenarios. Same practices, but according to the situation, you can adjust, you know. Now, I think before we go further, how about some questions from yesterday? Ask me, are there any questions there, people? Just to get clear about what we've discussed so far.
Does anyone have any questions for Rabina? You'd like to raise your hand? The blue hand.
Nothing there. Okay, well.
There's one from Malcolm Rabina.
Good, Malcolm. Talk to me.
Hi, Rabina.
Yes, darling.
My partner's mother is in a nursing home. She's been there for 5 years. She has dementia. The doctors, when she went in, said she probably had 1 to 2 years to live. Yes. She's completely dependent on cranes to lift her into bed and out of bed and into the shower and everything else. She has moments of great lucidity and moments when she's just talking about her husband who died years ago and her granny and all the rest of it.
Exactly.
So my question is, clearly the gross mind is in trouble, but is the subtle mind still present? And in talking to her about death, and we've begun that conversation a little bit, is there going to be recognition at that level?
Yeah, I understand. You know, I think, Malcolm, at this point, I think, and this is the same with it's like it's a mouse who doesn't understand things conceptually, or, you know, the real benefit is not from the discussion and for her to start recognizing she's dying. The most powerful way you can benefit, and this is where it's up to you to decide if you can do it, and you and your partner want, and whether, you know, I don't know, you haven't said, but just to let her hear mantras and prayers. You can't. There's no point in having discussions. It doesn't. Let her understand she's dying, but that's not really even the issue. It's to bless her mind. To bless her mind. Let her hear things that will bless her mind and leave imprints in the mind, so that when she does die, she'll have a connection with the Buddhas. Now, if she's devoted to God, you talk about God to her. You let her hear it. Whether she comprehends it doesn't matter. It's the subtler level. And that's why if a person's in a coma, you play mantras day and night. This, you couldn't possibly do better than that. Does that make sense? The
principle? Total.
That's it.
Yeah. Her father was a priest. So
her father was a priest.
Yeah.
So is she a Christian in her heart? Does she love God?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
Not sure, but in okay. that direction, I mean, yes, okay. Probably. You know, she goes to communion.
But I think, I mean, would you be happy to play mantras? Let her hear them quietly. Would you be happy to do that? Or do you feel like you're cheating her somehow? Because people often feel that.
I don't know. I don't feel 100%. I'm to talk to Emma about that. It's her mother.
How does she feel? Sorry, what is your partner's name?
Emma.
What does Emma want? What does Emma feel? What does she like? Does she sort of like some of the approaches that you have got, for example?
Absolutely. Yes. No, absolutely.
Okay.
Talk about
it. Okay. You see, the point about the mantra one, I feel it's not like trying to cheat a person. It's not trying to make them a Buddhist. It's to make them peaceful. And so if you've got one religious music and if she loves religious, just play Bach, play the masses to her, yeah. Whatever it is that will calm her mind, but leave an imprint of something more than eat, sleep and go to the toilet, more than just rock and roll, something that's more sublime, more transcendental. That's the point of it. And then because it's holy, it'll touch her mind deeply and leave an impression. So if you feel also Om Mani Padme Hum, because it's very non-sectarian, it's just this lovely sound, people singing mantras. Or Lama Zopa, for example, singing, you just go on YouTube. If you go on YouTube, you just put Lama Zopa YouTube Medicine Buddha. There's one like a 40 minutes of Rinpoche just chanting the Medicine Buddha. And it's the most marvelous sound. And if Emma likes it, then you could, I swear to you, Malcolm, you couldn't do better for her. There's nothing better you can do. Then do that.
That's so helpful. Thank you.
I understand. And the other one, if you see things, so if she does like Jesus, have pictures for her. Because she is still conscious, her senses are still working. And that's the thing about the very beginning point in the book. Has she got her own room?
Oh, yes.
Make it as beautiful as possible, as peaceful as possible. Because even though she's not kind of coherent, when her eyes are open, her senses are still working. So visually make everything peaceful and lovely. You know, that's really important, not be cluttered and ugly. And then the sounds is more subtle. So the sounds is the most powerful one. Because when she's dreaming and spacing out, the number of stories I can tell you, you know, about people who are unconscious in comas, how they can hear prayers and because they're more transcendental, they're more powerful. Mm-hmm. To make her mind peaceful. That's it. Even talk to her. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Do you understand?
So helpful. So helpful. Thank you.
Good, good. Thanks, Malcolm.
Thank you, Malcolm. Susie, would you like to unmute yourself and ask your question?
Yes, darling.
Thank you for the teachings.
Good, sweetheart.
Am I qualified enough to be able to guide somebody? Not qualified, but could I guide somebody through a purification that isn't a Buddhist but is willing to do it with me?
Of course, Tanya's. Of course you are. If you get the meaning of it sincerely and you can adjust it to the person's mind, of course you're qualified, sweetheart. Of course you are. Of course right. You are.
I have another question, if possible. Yeah. The creatures that die in our house, we sing to them and then I take them outside.
You've disappeared. What happened?
She must be having a problem with the internet connection. We'll maybe have to leave that and when she comes back.
Later, yeah.
Does anybody else have a question that they would like to ask Rabina? If you do, if you raise your blue hand, it just makes it a bit easier for me to see you. Or you can put it in chat.
Okay, just keep your questions in. We'll come soon. When okay. Susie comes back. Tell Susie we can when we have a next little section for questions she can ask then.
Yeah.
Okay, so again, all these practices, many of them you repeat all the way through these processes, you know. Susie, you there? You there, Susie? No, she's gone again.
She's gone completely, okay. Yeah.
Okay, fine. So all the practices Rinpoche recommends, like Medicine Buddha, is every scenario. You do it then. You do it the weeks and months before. You do it the days before. You do it at the time of death. You can do it 27 times. Some practices are only done at certain times, some are repeatedly. That's why they're all separate in the back of the book where you can refer to them. So here, once the mind has left the body, basically you've got dinner. You can feed it to the dogs. I mean, Rinpoche doesn't say that. I'm just being ridiculous. But get my point. The mind has gone. It's no longer a human. It's just the four elements. So, you know, but it's also, but you, so you now prepare the body to, you know, do the things that we do. They don't have a thing called a funeral in Tibet, but we understand the meaning. So then, you know, Rinpoche doesn't say much about a funeral, so we have to cobble together some things. So the things, once the mind has left, now you get it ready. You can either do cremation or bury, isn't it? Now, in Tibet, they had a third one. They have, and I don't know if they still do it, they call it sky burial. You get the body and get it, you go up to the mountains, and there's certain people whose job it is to chop up all the body and all the bits, of the soft bits and the hard bits, and all the big vultures are waiting. They're given the sign, and they come down, they eat the lot. It's very efficient. They lick the place clean, you know, all gone. So the same as if you bury. You know, you're offering the body to all the creatures. You know, I always make comments here about my own personal. I think cemeteries are an utter waste of real estate, but never mind. That's my personal view. Buddha doesn't say that, nor does Tibetans. But cremation is a common one for most of us, I suppose. I don't know. So the thing is, okay, we'll get to those sections. Offer the organs, we did that. Die suddenly, we did that. So now if your loved one is in high realizations, and we did all that too. And so then, now, there's some very interesting things here. I'd like to read you from this about Lama Yeshe. It's very, very moving. So this is still quite not quite finished yet. This is the last scenario if your loved one has high realization and is meditating at the time of death. So as I discussed in chapter 10, people with high tantric realizations can remain in meditation in the clear light conjoined with emptiness for as long as they wish. 1 hour, 3 days, many months. Some meditators stay in the clear light meditation in the hermitages for years. So that's how long they're meditating to get rid of all the delusions, right? So if your loved one is in meditation, you must not disturb them. So the face of the meditator is very radiant, peaceful, even blissful. They look magnificent, totally different from an ordinary dying person. Sometimes they even seem to be a light at the tip of their nose. While they're in meditation, even though the breath has stopped, there'll be no smell of decay. They smell the same as when they were alive. Or as I mentioned above, there could even be a sweet smell. I mentioned that. Lama Yeshe's body was in, you know, 5 days after he died. 5 days the body was kept in the coffin at Vajrapani. And that room, it really did smell sweet, you know. Here, the author of the Tibetan Ceremonies of the Dead advises that for somebody who is in meditation, you should not consult an astrologer about when to move the body until their meditation is over. Most of us won't do that anyway, but that's Tibetans, you know. There's a risk that the astrologer might recommend moving the body while the mind is still there. So if circumstances demand that you move the body. However, if the meditation is not over, but for various reasons, such as the country's laws, you have no choice but to move the body, you need to request the meditator to end their meditation. While you are requesting them, you can offer music with cymbals, bells, damarus, and so forth, as Song Rinpoche advised me when Lama Yeshe was in meditation. Or you could recite the Guhya Samaja root mantra, root tantra. More simply, you could put incense very close to the nose of the meditator, and it's very auspicious to recite prayers that they be born in a pure land. In the case of some holy beings, such as Ling Rinpoche and Lama Yeshi, even though their bodies were moved several times, their meditation did not cease and they were not disturbed. As I mentioned above, Ling Rinpoche meditated for 13 days after the breath had stopped. So as I mentioned in chapter 21, Lama Yeshi passed away at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles, a wonderful hospital. Before Lama passed away, the nurses were watching intently throughout the night. The moment Lama's heart stopped, people rushed in with a defibrillator and wanted to try to get it started again. It was all very hectic in the room. I had checked with Song Rinpoche, who earlier had come to be with Lama Yeshi, but now is back in Switzerland, and he said to do everything possible to save Lama. The defibrillator is very strong. It pulls the body up violently. Lama opened his eyes for a moment and then his body fell back down. The doctor then said there was no hope. It was about 5 o'clock in the morning, and this is in Tibetan New Year, Losar. This was my first time dealing with someone passing away in the West, and I had no experience. Apparently, they usually take the body to the mortuary where they prepare it, but I didn't think we needed to do that. That's for ordinary people, not for those who are in the meditative state like Lama. Anyway, Lama remained in meditation in a private room throughout the day. By the late afternoon, we couldn't stay there any longer, so I asked Song Rinpoche what should be done to release Lama from his meditation. As I mentioned, Rinpoche advised me to play instruments, so I made 3 prostrations, rang a bell, and requested Lama to stop. I also recited the prayer to be born in the Pure Land from the Vajrayogini practice, and I touched Lama's crown. This is the one we mentioned, that before you move the body, in every one of those scenarios, before you finally move the body, you do this very strongly at the crown chakra to pull the hair or tap strongly, this is including on animals, so that if the mind is still there, you help it leave from there, and that could be help the person get a Pure Land rebirth. Of course, Lama didn't need all of this, as he had already achieved the clear light and the illusory body, all the high realizations. Apparently, there was a candle, and one of the students present in the room said that he saw a second flame leap up from the flame nearby. I didn't see it. So they put Lama's holy body in a box packed in ice and took it to the mortuary. The box looked very dirty, you know, and the body was covered by what looked like to me like an animal skin, like the Tibetan nomads would use. The next day, one of the students very slowly drove it the 350 miles north to Lama's center near Boulder Creek, Vajrapani Institute. It was kept in the Gompa. When they were preparing Lama's body for the burning offering puja, usually it's the fire puja, but Rinpoche calls it that, Lozang, who had been one of the monks from the first Gelug monastery in Bodhanath Stupa in Nepal, and who was familiar with the rituals, reported to Song Rinpoche, because Song Rinpoche was there at Vajrapani. And even though the body had been lying in the coffin for many days, Lama's limbs were still flexible. It was he who prepared the holy body in the Tibetan way, putting on the self-initiation costume with the crown, bell, and vajra, and putting the legs and hands in the right position. He explained to Song Rinpoche that it was only when he moved Lama's legs that the white bodhicitta came out. In other words, it seems that Lama had been in meditation state for at least 5 days, even though the body had been moved many times. From the hospital to the mortuary, the long drive from Los Angeles to Boulder Creek, and then preparing it for the burning offering puja. Song Rinpoche was very surprised. Actually, Lama had told some students at Tushita Meditation Center in Dhamsala, he didn't tell me, that after he passed away, he would stay in meditation for 1 year and that he wanted the students to come to do Vajrasattva retreat for that year. He had checked in his collection of teachings about what lamas do when they pass away. He checked a lot. He had already planned to do this. When I asked Song Rinpoche about keeping Lama's body for 1 year, Rinpoche said that in Tibet, only the holy bodies of a few high lamas would be kept like this. If I were to do this, Rinpoche said, people might complain. You see, in the common view, Lama was not known as a great meditator. He did not have that title. Perhaps I was not strong enough in making it clear. So in the end, we did not keep Lama's body for a year and do the retreat. However, a Vajrasattva retreat was done in many places. Kopan Monastery, for example, held a retreat day and night continuously for 1 year. Perhaps the Ursa Ling Center in Spain held a retreat and other centers as well. I'm sure these retreats created so much benefit, pacifying the karmic obstacles of the students, enabling us to receive a very beneficial incarnation, Lama Tenzin Ursel Rinpoche, who was born to Spanish parents in 1984. So when the meditator's mind leaves the body of a meditator will start to smell when the meditation is finished. In other words, when the mind leaves, just like the bodies of ordinary people. One of Rinpoche's gurus and Lama Yeshi's friend, Jumpa Wongdu, the one I said was born as a Chinese boy in Hong Kong, He went into meditation. Maybe it mentions this. I'll wait till it comes. No, it doesn't. He was in meditation, sitting in his position. He was a Bhadragini practitioner. And he chose to die, sort of like holy suicide. They know when to leave their body. They're in charge of the process. And I'm putting it like that. They don't call it that. So he was in meditation for several days. And apparently I saw there were photos of him. People took photos over that period. He was in there with his meditation cloak and he's sitting up there meditating. But of course, all the gross body has ceased, but his subtle mind is still there. So because the senses have ceased, the body shrivels. And by the last day, I think 10 days or 3 days he was meditating. But the last pictures, his little body kind of shriveled up a bit, his little head poking up above the cloak, you know. But the body wasn't, it was still alive because his subtle mind was there. But it also didn't smell. It only starts to smell when the mind leaves. So as with ordinary people, the red and white drops coming out of the body is a sign that the meditator's mind has left the body. But both drops don't necessarily come out, such as with Lama himself, as well as in the case of Genjampa Wangdu, this one I just mentioned, a friend of Lama's who passed away in Dharamsala shortly after Lama. Genjampa Wangdu was one of my teachers. I had received from him the oral transmission of the practice called Chulen, or taking the essence. It's a particular pill that the doctors and the lamas make. They collect the different minerals and everything, and they make these pills, and then the meditators can live for years and years just on these. You get very skinny, but you get nourishment, you know. But Geshe-Lama Khonsho was so advanced, he didn't even need a pill. He lived on what they call wind chulen. He was able to take the essence from the air and be nourished. This shows how powerful his mind was, you know. So yogis in isolated places make pills from the essence of flowers, minerals, and so on, and can live just on these for long periods of time. They don't need food. So anyway, after bringing Lama's relics to Switzerland for blessing by Song Rinpoche, although, of course, Lama didn't need that, I went to Dharamsala for teachings from His Holiness the Dalai Lama. The day after the teachings had finished, the relics, this is mentioned, this is wrong editing, very bad. I should have referred to a chapter there, because Lama talks about this, Rinpoche talks about this in the funeral chapter, which comes later, so I didn't mention it here. It just says relics out of the blue. So when we do a reprint, I'll fix it. Excuse me. Personal note to myself. Okay. So Lama didn't need that. So I went to Dharamsala for teachings from His Holiness the Dalai Lama. The day after the teachings had finished, there was a long life puja for His Holiness, but I couldn't attend because Genjampa Wangdu passed away early that morning after being in meditation for, 3 days. One of the tantric monks and I checked to see if the bodhicitta, the drop, had come out. It seemed that the white bodhicitta had, but not the red. So not only had he had great success in achieving the three principal aspects of the path, Guru Rinpoche and so on, Guru devotion and so on, but also the six yogas of Naropa and the clear light and the illusory body, and he had experienced a transcendental non-dual great bliss voidness. Another sign that the mind has left the body of a meditator, whether they're sitting up or lying down, is that the head shifts. Also, the color of their face usually changes, becoming dark. But Genjampa Wangdu's face still looked very bright, exactly the same as when he was alive. No change. So when his body was taken to the place behind Tushita Retreat Center to be offered to the fire, one of his disciples was very worried that Geshe-la was still alive. He requested Kirti Senchab Rinpoche to come and say prayers and to check. Rinpoche simply looked at Geshe-la's face and could tell immediately that his meditation was over. So also it seems that Genjampa Wangdu had chosen to pass away on the very day of His Holiness the Dalai Lama's long life puja so that His Holiness could live a long life. In other words, he sacrificed his own life for His Holiness. People talk about that Lama like that as well. These Lamas who passed away in that year was the year of many obstacles for His Holiness. So they kind of give their life. I don't quite understand how that works. So great meditators can choose where to go after birth. Many great practitioners become enlightened in the intermediate state or go to a pure land. Many others reincarnate in human form again in order to help sentient beings, as Lama Yeshe did. For great practitioners such as Lama, they can choose their parents and the environment they will be born into, and the child they become is completely different from normal people. Okay, so now. So there's a final little chapter here to make sure that the mind has left before you move it. And there's various things you can do. So one is if it's warm at the heart, I mentioned that. If you put your hand just above the heart chakra, it'll be vividly warm if the mind is still there. The rest of the body will be cold. But if it's cold there, it means the mind is gone. The white and red drops come out, or the body smells. These are all signs the mind has left. Or the flesh doesn't respond. If you touch your flesh and the mind is there, the flesh will come back. But if the mind is gone, the flesh, it stays in, you know. the head moves, these things, okay. So now also, now the practice is to do after the mind has left the body. So various things, how to prepare your loved one's body for cremation or burial. So now the first, this next practice, get some sesame or mustard seeds, say, or talcum powder, water, perfume, or something you can easily sprinkle. Now recite the Namgyelma mantra 21 times. That's in the book, Long Life Deity. The long mantra is better, but the short mantra is good. Or any other mantra that you know, such as the Compassion Buddha mantra. So having blessed your breath with the recitation, now blow on the seeds or water or whatever, blessing them. So now sprinkle it over the body. I usually keep a big packet of mustard seeds or baby powder close by. Every day after I've chanted thousands of various mantras, I blow on the powder or seeds to bless them. I use them whenever I see dead insects or animals or for people who have died. You could also do this, and you could send the blessed seeds to other people for them to use when people die. So Rinpoche, you know, he's driving along and he sees a dead deer. He'll hop out of the car and he'll have his little bag of blessed stuff and he'll sprinkle it on and say prayers in their ears and do his best to help them, you know, to help their mind. We can do that the same. The Namgyelma mantra is especially powerful for purification of negative karma. For example, whoever is touched by the wind that is blown on mantras written on cloth or paper and placed on a mountain top will be purified of their negative karma. Circumambulating a stupa that contains the mantra purifies the karma to be reborn in the hot hells. Next practice, bless your loved one's body with written mantras. This is one of the practices throughout. If you have not already put written mantras on the body of your loved one, it's especially good to do so now. See, that's the thing too, Malcolm, depending on your, on Emma's mummy. You know, like Catholics, we had, I don't know if high church, if she's high church or not, but we had called scapular prayers and wrapped in cloth and you'd wear it around your neck. So, I mean, I don't know if Emma's into that kind of thing. That could be incredibly beneficial for your mummy. If you get Rinpoche's book, you'll see. You can put mantras like wrapped in a cloth and prayers and have it around her neck by her heart. It's up to what Emma wants, you know. But if you look at Rinpoche's book, there's all these different types of things you could do. And you'll see. It's very, very helpful, all these things. Of course, Rinpoche's got faith in all these things. We know that. He's got incredible faith in all these seemingly esoteric things. But the power of speech, the power of blessings, the power of mantras. So lots of these things, Rinpoche would always say help. A blessing string, even, putting it around your Emma's mummy's throat, you know. And then, or the mantras, and then you'd bury her or you'd have them on the body. And another one Rinpoche talks about here, I'll tell you. So bless your loved ones with written mantras. You could use the 11 mantras that I wrote out, as discussed in chapter 18, or the Namgyelma mantra, one of the best to use. You can also use small protection mantra in the liberation box. This is a little box Rinpoche put together. I don't know if it's still available from FPMT, but there's stupa in it. There's his mantras, his blessing string, different things. Bless pills. If you like, you could use any of the five great mantras, all there in the book. You can put the sheets of mantras on any part of the body so the words are touching the skin. So you could also put rolls of mantras on the body, on the head, for example, or you could wrap mantras around the body, the chest, for example. As Kirti Center Rinpoche explained that they do in AMDO. So they have these long rolls of paper, so they literally wrap the body in mantras. You could also leave the mantras there when the body's buried or cremated. This helps purify negative karma and cause a good rebirth. You can do this for animals as well. So now your next one is you retain the ashes, hair or nails to be blessed later. Make sure you keep some hair or nails if the body will be buried and ashes if it will be cremated to be blessed later in a Jungwa ceremony and included in holy objects. So these two practices are mentioned later. So now the funeral service, you could invite a lama or a monk or a nun or to lead the ceremony. Use any of the practices recommended to do during the 49 days after the death of your loved one. Or you could select verses from these various practices. You could start with the motivation and then talk about impermanence. You could also talk about your loved one's life and rejoice in all their good actions. And that's what tends to be. People have them as a rejoicing ceremony, which is good. But of course, the Buddhist approach would be to remind people that's going to be them. It's impermanence, you know. So you could offer lights or flowers or, you know, do those things. You could recite the different mantras, the different practices in the book. You could do any of these. You could recite the King of Prayers, which is a really common one they all do. And then, now this is Lama's funeral. It's a bit about Lama now. It's very nice again. So this is what I did. So, okay. Remember, as I said in chapter 26, you'll have your loved one's body cremated. If you have, don't forget to keep some ashes or some hair you can have them blessed with the Jhangwa practice, as I discuss in the next chapter. So this is what I did with all of Lama Yeshe's relics after the burning offering puja at Vajrapani Institute in California. I first took them to Switzerland and asked Song Rinpoche to bless them with Jhangwa ceremony. Although, of course, as I mentioned earlier, owing to his realizations, Lama did not need that. The relics were divided up and given to the centers around the world. The ashes were offered to the students and they made satsars, these little kind of bas-relief Buddha images. We'll discuss this later. This is something, when we get to it, Malcolm, this is really, again, a powerful thing that people could do. All these things are to help the mind of the person, plus to help us create merit. So they also received the ashes in little capsules. Remember that, while I was there, we all got these little capsules, vitamins to strengthen the weak mind. The ceremony we had for Lama was a Yamantaka fire offering. Students came from everywhere. Geshe Sopa from Wisconsin, Geshe Tinle, one of Lama Yeshe's brothers, came from Australia, where he was resident teacher at Chenrezig. I had invited Song Rinpoche to come again from Switzerland. Before the burning offering puja, we did many days of practices, including the Haruka Bodhi Mandala self-initiation, Vajrayogini, Guru Puja, and we all offered the Bodhisattva Tsog, written by Lama, with prostrations to the 35 Buddhas. I mean, the ceremonies went on for 5 days. I remember I was there. Finally, we were ready to offer Lama's holy body to the fire. A special cremation stupa was built according to Song Rinpoche's design. Lama was dressed in the costume of self-initiation, put upright on a chair, tied securely, and then carried to the site and placed in the stupa. Rinpoche himself did a lot of work in his own hands, with his own hands putting in the bricks, putting the firewood around Lama's holy body in the lower part of the stupa, and then helping build up the top part and making the holes for offering the ingredients of the fire puja. Everything went so well. He doesn't say any more. I mean, there's many reports of that cremation, but not in Rinpoche's words. So, but it went on for several hours, and then eventually it's a 3 days. You seal up the stupa, then after 3 or 4 days, you open up the stupa, and then you look in there. And I think he mentions it here. Let's just see if he mentions. And then they find what they call relics, you know. In some of the lamas, you find pearls, all kinds of precious things, which are the manifestation of an indication of their realizations. So now, how to bless your loved one's ashes and include them in holy objects. This is something really anyone can do. So again, it's up to how people feel. You bless the ashes, hair, nails, and so forth of your loved one with Jhangwa. So as soon as after the funeral service is possible, you could organize a Jhangwa practice during which the Buddha's wisdom is invoked into the remains, thus purifying and blessing them. As I mentioned, you need only a small amount of the ashes, of bones or nails or the like. Keeping the ashes of your loved one, this is this whole point here now, keeping the ashes of your loved one that haven't been blessed has no benefit for the dead or the living. Whereas, as Kirti Sen Rinpoche said, now that the ashes are purified and blessed with Jhangwa, this is quite a long practice, and you can do it yourself, but it's best to have people who are qualified to do it in the monasteries, you know, or in the centers, the lamas. It takes several hours. Once they've been blessed, they become relics. This is incredible benefit. Rinpoche talks about how even if somebody has died and they've got going to the lower realms, by doing this practice, you can help reverse it. I think he says this. Yeah, he says right here, even if the person dies with non-virtuous thoughts, which usually means it's definite to be born in the lower realms, and they are in the intermediate state, you can help them change direction and receive a human body instead, or even go to the pure lands by relying on Jhangwa. They're on the way to the lower realms, but because of the power of the Vajrayana, the power of the Buddha's words, and the power of the meditation of the Lama or the person who does the practice, suddenly the person changes their journey. Then you can dedicate to your loved one all the merits created by doing the blessing, praying that their negative karma is purified and that they receive a perfect human rebirth, or rebirth in a pure land, meet the perfectly qualified virtuous friend, hear the holy Dharma, and achieve enlightenment. So who can do the practice? The practice of Jhangwa is usually performed by qualified lamas. You can ask the lama at your nearest Tibetan Buddhist center to perform it, or you can ask monks or nuns to do it. If you can't get anyone, then you do it yourself. It's not in the book, but you can get it from FPMT, and FPMT's address is there. Originally, Jhangwa was done in the conjunction with Buddha Kunrik, who, as I mentioned in Practice 27, is known as the King of Deities, for purifying the lower realms. Eventually, other Buddhas were used, such as Medicine Buddha, Vajrayogini, and Maitreya. The practice I recommend is in association with the Medicine Buddha. So at the end of Jhangwa is Poa, shooting the consciousness into a pure land. Another practice you can do is you make tsatsa images or statues or stupas using the blessed ashes. This is something I find really helpful. You know, I'll tell you what Rinpoche says. So now you can do even more benefit to your loved one. Having blessed the ashes with Jhangwa, you can include them in holy objects such as satsas. These satsas are little small, usually bas-relief images of the Buddha. You can make them, you know, done out of plaster or things. You can include them in holy objects such as satsangs, statues, and stupas, which bring so much benefit both to your loved one and to you. As I mentioned in Practice 87, it is said that if a person is destined to be reborn in the lower realms, making a holy object, even simply on their behalf, can change the situation and help them get a good rebirth. Rinpoche is a fan of all these practices. Some people say, in other words, the point here, Malcolm, too, for everybody, there are some practices that we need to do ourselves, but there are some that relate to the Buddhas, that involve the Buddhas or mantras or power of speech that even don't need any intention from the side of the person. That's why we can help so many more people. You know, humans, if we're still, you know, got our wits about us, we can do practices. This is important. But most of us aren't capable. Or if you're, you know, in a coma or you've got Alzheimer's or you've lost the plot, or you're an animal, you're a baby, then you don't need to worry about what they can do with their own cognition. You do these practices, which is the power of the holy objects. Rinpoche has got incredible confidence in these practices, you know. And the thing is, people feel that all people want to do something, especially the animals. They want to do something. So to think of putting mantras around your animal, to let them hear the mantras, it makes people very happy. And then even you bless the ashes and you make them into satsas. I remember a friend, one mother, her boy died. He was like 40. The boy had a wife and children. And of course, the wife was just beyond devastated. He's a young man, you know. And there are the ashes in the canister on her mantelpiece, sitting there. I mean, it's almost like sinister. She couldn't bear to think of putting them anywhere because she didn't know what to do with them. But then the thought, I said to the mother, why don't you get them blessed and then put them into, make satsa. So you've got these little images of Buddha. Even for people, because even non-Buddhists think it's art. They like it, you know. The Buddha makes them feel happy. So you make these satsas with blessed ashes of your loved one and you put them into this and you give them to the children, give them to the grandma. It makes people happy. It's sent us this instead of a canister of ashes, you know. It, every time they see that Buddha image, it's their loved one's ashes in there. So it's benefit for the loved one, benefit for you. It's got real benefit. Some people say that you shouldn't put ordinary people's ashes in holy objects. But as I said, by doing the practice of Junghwa, the wisdom of the Buddhas has been invoked into them, thus purifying and blessing them. So including the blessed ashes in satsas or other holy objects creates inconceivable merit for your loved one and also for you. Typically, people offer flowers or lights to a loved one at the cemetery, but this doesn't accumulate any merit. It's not even virtuous. It's just sort of, it's meaningful because we're touched by it, but there's no virtue, you know. But now, because you are offering to a holy object, you create huge amounts of merit. You can decide which Buddhas you use for the tsatsa or statue, medicine Buddha, Amitabha, compassion, whatever. You could ask a lama for or Tibetan astrology, which Buddha would be best. Or as I mentioned, you can make a stupa. You can also make these holy objects yourself, or you can request Dharma centers to make them for you. There's different addresses in the book that you can refer to who can help you. There are FPMT centers set up for this purpose in Australia, New Zealand, and the United States, where stupas can be made and kept in memorial shrines where you can visit and make offerings. Another practice is you can throw the blessed ashes into the wind or water. People like to do that, but bless them first. There's no benefit otherwise. If you like, you could also throw some of the blessed ashes into the wind from a high mountain or into the sea, a lake, a river, and so on. Every sentient being touched by the ashes in the air or by the water is purified of the obscurations and negative karma. That helps people's minds. Now, next chapter, what to do now during the 49 days. After the mind has left, once the body is finished, now you've got practices for the next 49 days. So the monasteries, of course, they would have pujas day and night, you know, and you can decide what you do. There's many different things you can do. So there's a whole bunch of things. So it can take up to 49 days after the mind has left the body for your loved one to take a new rebirth. It is traditional to perform prayers, pujas, offerings, and so on during the 7 weeks, dedicating the merits to the person who's passed away. So as I mentioned in chapter 18, when people who care about a person do practices together, there's much more benefit. So the ideal, of course, would be to do prayers and practices for your loved one throughout the entire 7 weeks, day and night. When Lama Pasang passed away at Kopan, Lama Lundrup had 3 or 4 monks at any time reciting the extensive medicine Buddha practice all day, every day for the 49 days. Some people do practices once a week for 7 weeks, others every day. You do what you can. You can request monasteries to do any of these practices for your loved one. There are 4 possibilities of what can happen after the mind leaves the body. The karma that has been activated at the time of death was virtuous, and the mind is still in the intermediate state. So for this person, You can pray that your loved one is born in the Pure Lands, where they can achieve enlightenment or receive a perfect human rebirth, where they can meet a person qualified, a perfectly qualified Mahayana guru and the Mahayana teachings, and then achieve enlightenment. Number two, the karma that was activated at the time of death was virtuous, and the mind has already taken rebirth in the human realm or the Pure Lands. So in this case, it's still beneficial to do prayers and practices. Dedicate all the merit from doing these practices for the person who has passed away. Three, the karma that was activated at the time of death was non-virtuous and the mind is still in the intermediate state. This means the person will be born in the lower realms. It's possible, though, that prayers and practices can help the mind change direction and instead receive a human body or even be reborn in a pure land, as I mentioned in chapter 9. Practices such as jungwa, powa, making a stupa on behalf of your loved one. These are all practices which she recommends that can help change the karma after the mind is gone. Four, the karma that was activated at the time of death was non-virtuous and the mind has already taken rebirth in the lower realms. I mean, this is the worst scenario. But still, we say so optimistic. Again, in this case, it's even possible to liberate a person from the lower realms, as I discuss in relation to Buddha Kunrik and Jungwa. So these, you know, we say is very optimistic. So then, lots of prayer practices. Just mentioning many, recite the medicine Buddha, sponsor monasteries and Dharma centers to do these things, recite the 8 prayers to benefit the dead, recite the King of Prayers, request a lama to do mpowa, all the different practices, all in the back of the book. Make offerings of sur, another particular practice called offering of sur, S-U-R. After they die, all beings except those destined for the formless realms have to go through the intermediate state, the bardo. Because the body of beings in the intermediate state is subtle, it's like a subtle, you know, subtle, it's like in a dream state. As discussed in chapter 9, their only food is smells. This is all they can consume. Thus, they are sometimes called smell eaters. It is excellent to make offerings of the smell of food to them with a practice called sur. Yamusha does this all the time. You see him sometimes with this little kind of thing over his head and he's out there in the water. He's doing these practices. The Tibetan word sur refers to the smell of roasted barley flour. Chodron Rinpoche advised that the practice can be done 3 times each day, in the morning, in the afternoon, and the evening. The practice has many benefits. It pacifies obstacles. It's an offering to the Guru, Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. It's a practice of charity to all beings of the 6 realms, in particular the intermediate state beings, those who've passed away from the human and other realms and have not yet been reborn. So you finish your karmic debts. It's a method for helping me be born in the Pure Lands. It's a cause of success of whatever wishes you have. By doing it, you collect so much merit, purify obstacles, and all your wishes are achieved according to the Holy Dharma. You complete the blah, blah, blah. So, okay, Rinpoche Rinpoche tells a story about someone imprisoned in Tibet for many years. I think this is Rinpoche himself, because he was in prison for 19, 20 years in appalling situations, incredible suffering. I wouldn't be surprised if it's himself, but Rinpoche doesn't say this. So they were given, he was imprisoned for many years. They were given very small amounts of food, a dish called teen momo, but they didn't receive any actual momo dumplings, only small pieces of flour in thin soup that was basically water. Because the prisoners were unbelievably hungry, when they went outside their rooms, they would search for bones in the fields, which they would chew. Even this gave them such strength and changed their bodies, Rinpoche said. They would also poke around with a stick in the feces of the Chinese staff, looking for undigested beans, which they would eat. The Chinese staff kitchen was nearby, so the starving Tibetan prisoners could smell the frying food. This Tibetan person said, I'm sure this is Rinpoche himself, Rinpoche. This Tibetan person said that the smell would help so much. It would sustain him. When he was freed, he decided he would offer sur every day to the spirits, the smell eaters, because of his experience of hunger and how even the smell of food helped him so much. You could practice Dodi Kado offering food. There's so many other. There's a fire puja. It's in the book. You could offer lights, you can do flowers, all the practices listed, lots of things you can do. You could offer money on behalf of your loved ones. This is really powerful. Offering money to organizations that help, such as charities, collects inconceivable merit, which you can then dedicate for your loved one. As well as making these offerings during the 49 days, you could also do so on the holy days of the Tibetan lunar calendar, such as the Buddha days, when the merit is multiplied 100 million times. If, say, you were offered $1, you would collect the merit of having offered $100 million, blah, blah, blah. So years ago, I started putting aside money in a fund to fund pujas and the construction of stupas and prayer wheels. We now have the FPMT Puja Fund, the main purpose of which is to collect merit by making offerings to monasteries, such as the 3 main Guduk monasteries in South India, and so on and so forth. So you can make offerings, all these lists of things you can do, all for the benefit of your loved one. sponsor Dharma activities with your loved one's money. You know, you could sponsor someone to do a retreat. You could use money to make a contribution to a Dharma center. You could publish a book, for example. Make holy objects on behalf of your loved one. You know, not so much the one of putting ashes in, but make statues and things on behalf of your loved one. There are many practices to do. You could do a retreat, so many things. He mentions all the practices. And finally, and that's it. That's the end of the book. That's it. And then you've got 2/3 of the book, which is the practices themselves. Now we're done. Another 2 hours to go. Never mind. Ask me some questions. Come on. I've got to lead the practice. We'll do that in the final session. I'll lead the purification practice. So other questions?
Thank you, Venerable Robina. Maybe Susie, would you like to ask a question because you lost your internet connection last time? Is that okay?
Yes, thank you. I don't know what happened there. So the creatures that pass away in our house, we all sing mantras over them. And then I just put them in the garden. Is it best to keep them inside the house for a few days?
They're dead.
I know, but to keep singing mantras on them. Yes, yes.
No, you're talking about the dead ones?
Yeah.
Okay, so you say mantras, but do you blow on them?
Yeah.
You got to blow on them. Good.
Okay, yeah, we do.
Okay, that's fine. So if they're dead, doesn't matter. Put them out. Doesn't matter. They're gone. The consciousness is very likely gone. But to be on the safe side is put them in a safe place outside, because if the mind is still there, it's sort of surprising if the mind of a little ant is still there, but you never know. So if you're going to sing the mantras, you know, on them, put them in a safe place first, maybe get a little box or something and wait for a few days, and then you're certain the mind is gone. Then you can chuck them out and put them in the bin. Doesn't matter. Do you understand?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the last doesn't talk much about how long it takes for an insect's mind to leave the body. It's more than likely immediate. But you just don't know. You just don't know. You understand?
You clear? Thank you.
Okay, Don.
Yeah, I'm clear.
Good,
Don. Thank you, Susie. Thank you. We've got a question in the chat, and then I'll come to you, Kelly. Yeah. So, Kimberly, would you like to ask your question?
Yes, darling.
Hi. I have, I'll just be honest here. I have a mum who I love very deeply, but she is one of those rare predatory style personalities. So she's not involved in my family's life, and I'm very, very concerned about her.
So what do you mean by rare predatory? What do you mean by that? Explain what delusions she's got, you think, Kimberly. What do you mean by that?
I don't know entirely. She fits the description for malevolent, narcissistic personality disorder style.
That's Western words. So you mean she's got lots of attachment and she's selfish? Would you suggest that?
She's selfish she takes glee from hurting other people.
Well, that's your projection. That's your view. She might.
It's a lot of people's views.
Well, I don't care about other people. We're trying to see her mind. Okay, so then your mother is born with attachment, strong attachment to get what she wants. She's also got naturally has been very selfish as a result of that. Does she get angry easily?
Yeah.
She gets angry easily. She probably gets jealous. She gets jealous and resentful.
Yes, and she can be vengeful. So
and she's jealous and angry. So she's a very suffering person. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, and she.
Do you agree with that? She's a very suffering person.
Absolutely.
Okay, so how can you help her, sweetheart?
I don't know. I spent a lot of my life thinking that I could love my mom into being better, feeling better.
That's the false expectation. That's our problem. It's a very fascinating point, Kimberly. It's a very common thing. The problem is, you know, first of all, you're noticing your mother has a bunch of delusions. Well, join the universe. She's not rare, sweetheart. I'm sorry. She's not rare. She's like a normal person. But because she's your mum, her delusions loom much larger than if I met your mother. I'd probably see your mother's good qualities. I think your mother's funny. I'd probably crack jokes with your mum. But our mother always looms much larger for us than everybody else. Maybe other people in the family. That's just how it is for a start. So first of all, The different levels of practice for you, one of the ones is, well, it's your mother. And guess who created the course to be born into her womb? You ran like a magnet to her womb, baby. So you've got a strong, intense history with this person. So that means you have a responsibility to this person. So, of course, as a child, we don't know what to do. We're completely confused and lost. We don't know why. You're a needy little girl wanting to be loved, and suddenly you get whacks and the weird things, and we're very confused. So we have to grow up to process it. So then, of course, at some point as a child, you can't handle it because your needs and your intensity of your attachment and your fears and your disappointments are too strong. So you need some space from your mummy. But the other biggest problem, Kimberly, what you just said before, you think I'm going to love my mother, which is amazing, but the expectation is that she's going to damn well get better. And so you're disappointed because she didn't get better. That's your mistake. You don't expect a python to start not behaving like a python just because you're kind to it. That's naive and your problem. That's your attachment. Are you seeing my point? Your mummy is who she is. She is the one who's suffering. She is the one who's then, of course, causes others suffering. So you do what you can. You stay away if you can't handle it. But as we all progress in our own practice and get stronger and wiser, then eventually a person like that is water off a duck's back. The only reason we suffer in relation to a person like this is because we haven't done enough work on our own minds. So that's reasonable. If you can't cope, you stay away from your mummy. Absolutely. Yeah. But as you progress spiritually and as you progress getting rid of your own attachment, your own fears, you'll understand your mummy and she'll become less fearful to you. And then you'll just be able to love her. You really will be able to love her with no expectations. But the biggest problem is you expected her to behave nicely and to respond to your love and change. And that's disappointing for us. Well, that's your problem, not hers.
Yeah. You see, I'm trying to pass that. I'm past that point right now.
That's good. So you never see your mother? You never see your mother? No, wait, let me ask you questions. Do you ever see your mother?
No, not recently. Not
where is your mother? She's thousands of miles away or nearby or what?
In the same town.
And you choose not to see her because you can't cope?
Well, yeah. I mean, I had serious concerns that she might light the house on fire. So,
She means she's seriously mentally ill. She would burn her house down. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. This isn't just what? Like... Yes, she's seriously mentally ill. Like,
she's not locked up in a home and getting care if she's that mentally ill?
No, she's not.
She burns houses down. Is that what you're saying?
Potentially.
What do you mean potentially?
Well, I don't like to.
She ever burned a house down?
No, but she's driven her car into someone's house. So it's not, it's a matter of.
Lots of anger. Okay, she's an angry person. Okay. Yeah. Does she have any friends?
I'm not sure how many anymore. I think
she has some friends.
Yeah, she has a partner. She has a husband.
Oh, okay. And he loves her?
I think so.
Well, that's interesting. That's a good point already, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's two things here. And this is the key thing, Kimberly. There's the work you have to do on your mind.
Yeah.
To break down your projections and your fears and your dramas and your expectations and your disappointment and your hurt, which is the lenses that you're seeing your mummy through. You understand my point here? Do you recognize that?
I do to a certain degree. I guess.
Stop for a second. What do you mean to a certain degree? This is a really important discussion, darling. And we're discussing this. You're bringing it up, but this is a story for every one of us trying to be Buddhist. There are our projections. So you know, there's one thing is your mother and there's you. There's two separate things. And then because she's your mother and because you're a normal person who's got attachment and your own fears and your own jealousies and your own resentments and your own projections. I mean, if you recognize that you've got those, then you understand what Buddha's saying. So they are the lenses through which you're seeing your mother, which make you fearful and worried and upset. They're your problem, not your mother's. And this is what Dharma practice is from the beginning, from the first step. So the more you work on your mind and lessen your delusions and your fears and your attachment and your worries and your projections and your anger, the more clearly you will see your mother and you'll even be able to see some good qualities and she won't make you so fearful.
Yeah.
Are we communicating?
Yeah. I was just wondering.
So keep working on your mind, baby.
Is there any way to help someone who's dying, like if you're not involved directly in their life?
So I'm confused now. What does this got to do with your mother? I'm a bit confused.
If my mom were to die tomorrow, I would be worried about her heading for the.
But I just told you all the things when I talked to Malcolm. All these practices I'm just reading now.
Yeah.
Well, that's and it. That's the answer, darling.
Okay.
There's so many things you can do without involving your mother. This is what I'm just reading now. All these things you can do if you have confidence in these practices. There's so much you can do for your mother without having anything to do with your mother. Okay. You can have prayers done, right? You can have practices done. You can bless her ashes. All the things I've just read, sweetheart, are for your mother.
Yeah.
You have the power. But if a husband runs the show, you have no power over it. So you've got to decide. You've got to see what power you've got. but you can have prayers and pujas done. Absolutely, darling. But it seems to me a really good part of your practice before you die, before she dies, is to continue working on your mind and getting rid of your own projections and your own fears. And don't say to a certain extent, there is your mother and she's got problems, but you're seeing your mother through your lenses. Do you recognize that?
Yeah. I just feel a lot of love for my mom. I don't know. I love my mom. I just love my mom.
What do you mean by love your mom? What do you mean by love?
I want what's best for my mom. I love my mom.
Good, good. That's perfect. But still, can you see that? I mean, this is the basic Buddhist path. Whether it's your mother or a dog, we have our own delusions. We have our own projections. Do you recognize that or not?
Yeah.
So your job is to continue to work on your mind. And one of your practices then on the compassion wing is to start seeing some of your mother's good qualities. Write them down. Start making a list. Because right now you see, as you said, rare, predatory, you know, all these things. You said those words.
Yeah.
So you're seeing only your mother's problems. You're seeing only your mother's delusion. This is very common. We all do this. So as your practice personally in your own mind, nothing to do with anybody else, start. And this is why the compassion meditations are so powerful. Your mother give birth to you?
Yeah.
And your mother didn't abort you, did she?
No.
This is enough reason to be utterly grateful to your precious mother. Your mother fed you?
Yeah.
Or was it your father who fed you? Your mother fed you. Your mother picked you up when you fell down. She gave you food. She tied your shoelaces. She helped you wipe your dirty bottom. She got up at night. Did you agree she did all these things?
Absolutely, yeah.
Then you start to think of these and start making a list, and basically you're going to paint a new picture of your mother. It doesn't mean she's not neurotic. It doesn't mean she doesn't do bad things. But the very way that all delusions work in our mind is that they exaggerate. So if you're in love with your mother and you'll see her, she's like a saint. Many people think their mothers are totally perfect, even though they're mean, a bit mean and a bit nasty, but they adore their mother because they're seeing their mother through the lens of attachment. You're seeing your mother through the lens of aversion and fears, and you're right in the things that she's done, but they've tainted your mind. Are you seeing my point? It's an amazing practice. The wisdom wing is to work on your mind, see your own attachment, your own fears, your own needs, your own anger, because clearly your mother hurt you and upset you through your life. And because you're not an angry girl, then you probably kept placating mummy and trying to make mummy happy, then always get disappointed when she didn't behave any better. That's your problem, not hers. You've got to see what your part of it is, and you've got to see her part. They're very different. This is a very powerful practice, and this is the wisdom wing. This is the first level of practice, sweetheart.
Yeah.
Do you understand me? And then the compassion side, when you're more brave and more clear, you can start to think of the good things and start making a list, and you'll literally be painting a new picture of your mum. It doesn't mean she's not attached. It doesn't mean she's not nasty. It doesn't mean she doesn't drive cars through people's houses. It doesn't mean she didn't do any of those things, but they don't define her.
Yeah.
This is the job we have to do, sweetheart. It's a very powerful practice. This is in your own mind. You don't need to tell your mother this. And then one day you'll feel different about her, and you'll be able to give her a call and tell her you love her and thank her for being a good mum and being kind to you. That's what you can do eventually.
Yeah, I tried that. She just yells at me.
No, sorry. You're missing the point again. I did not say that you can do that and then she'll be nice to you. That's your bottomless pit of attachment to be approved of by your mum. That's your problem, Kimberly, and we're all the same. In other words, your love of your mother's got strings attached. You think, how dare she not respond to me because I'm loving her, but she keeps jumping at me. That's not the point. You're missing the point completely, and we all do this, Kimberly. Can you hear my point here? You're expecting her to behave differently. That's your attachment. That's your emotional hunger that wants your mummy to be nice to you now. You're always disappointed. So you keep thinking, if I keep being kind to her, she'll be nice to me back one day. That's completely manipulative, and that's your problem. You've got to put no strings and love her for who she is and let her shout at you. So one day you'll be able to say, Mum, I love you. You'll write her a letter. Dear Mum, I love you so much and I thank you for everything you've done for me as a mother. I don't care if she burns it and sends you the ashes. That isn't the point.
Yeah,
can you hear me?
Absolutely.
Oh, darling. Keep practicing. I like that.
Thank you.
Good, sweetheart.
Thank you, Kimberly. Thank you. Kelly, would you like to unmute you?
Thank you. My lovely dad passed away 16 years ago.
Who did, darling? Sorry, who?
My dad.
Good, darling. Okay. I mean, not good. Yes, I understand.
My mum has his ashes sitting in a box in the house.
Yes.
Couldn't bear to say goodbye to him. Now, although he never recognised himself as Buddhist. He was really influenced by one of his friends who was Buddhist.
Yeah, right.
With a lot of Buddhist psychology, a lot of the principles.
Right.
He never practiced as a Buddhist, so he still had a lot of attachment, etc. Is it still worth getting his ashes blessed, making them into...
Of course it is, darling. God Almighty. Of course it is. Of course it is. It's the most precious thing you can do for your daddy.
Because even if it's not going to do any harm, is it going to create... Even if he managed to get a human rebirth, it's not going to do any harm. And if he went to the lower realms...
It can only benefit him. I mean, as Rinpoche says, even if you've got a human rebirth, it's still beneficial to do these practices.
Yeah.
It can only benefit.
I didn't know the length of time, whether that would make...
I mean, no matter what, darling, who cares?
Thank you.
Okay. Good, darling. Okay. Wonderful.
Thanks,
you
don't
have to have all of them blessed. You can have all of them blessed, but even just a little bit is enough, and you mix them, then you can have them made into these stupas. And I'm sure your mummy will be so happy with one of these. Look in the book when you get it, and it'll show you the different centres that make these little stupas, all these little kind of tatas. So special, darling. Absolutely. Good, Kelly. Olya.
Thank you, Kelly. Olya.
Thank you, dear Ravina. You were talking about Yidam. I'm wondering how would one go about in starting to recognize what's their Yidam is. Because my understanding is that Yidam would be a deity associated with your core delusion.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. So because we have so many of them, how does one go about to start recognizing what's their core delusion? Yes, that's.
But that's called practice, Olya. That's called Dharma practice. If you don't see your mind, like I'm talking to Kimberly right now, and what I was pointing out, she's like the rest of us, not being personal. She's got to see her own delusions. She's got to see her own attachment, her own anger. We've got to see our own minds. This is the junior school entry level, high school. This is the first level of practice, Olya. If we don't know our own mind, we're not doing the job properly. It's like we're being demented. If you don't know your own mind, if you don't know your own delusions, how can you change your mind? How can you practice every day? It's impossible. That's our problem when we get so caught up, not saying you, get up in all the tantric things, we get so esoteric and cosmic. We haven't got a clue about our own mind. If you don't know your own mind, Olya, you're not practicing Dharma. I'm not being rude. We're all the same. So you've got to know your own mind, sweetheart. How do you do that? By practicing Dharma, by knowing Buddhist, studying Buddhist psychology. By first you live in vows. You control your body, you control your speech. You control the servants of your crazy delusions. You stop killing, you stop stealing, you stop lying. You do bucket loads of purification. You do Vajrasattva every day. You put atomic bombs under all the delusions. You remove the delusions from your mind. You remove the imprint. So you start to see your own mind. Then you practice being your own therapist. And you do meditation every day. And you learn what is attachment, what is anger, what is jealousy. And then you see your mind. You see your delusions. If you don't know your own main delusions, it's like you're practicing piano for years and you don't know what you're doing. You don't know where your mistakes are because you haven't noticed. So this is Dharma practice, darling.
Sure. I thank you, Ravina. I guess my point here too, because I know that I have a number of delusions, right? So if I understand,
84,000 delusions, Olya, like the rest of us. You're 80,000.
Yeah, exactly. 80 over thousands and thousands. So if I understand correctly, the point is when I practice and get to know my mind better, I realize what the strongest ones are, right?
That's what Dharma practice is, Olya. There is nothing but that. You have no choice. That is being a Buddhist. The key job of being a Buddhist from here to enlightenment is your ability to distinguish between the delusions and the virtues. This is the job of being a Buddhist. This is the job of being a Buddhist.
Okay, but I also am able to recognize then going forward in practice, which... between the delusions, right? Which one would be the one that I overcome more easily, and which one is actually the one that is ingrained so much in me that more than any other than other delusions, right? And this is the core. This is then the core delusion. Am I thinking correct? Is my thinking correct?
I wouldn't call it the core delusion. No. all the we are all variations of the same map of the mind. Buddha's map of the mind is very clear, and he gets it all down to the three poisons. Ego grasping, which is the root delusion, which gives rise to attachment, which gives rise to aversion. They're the three primordial, fundamental ones. And then all the other branch ones that come from those. So each of us is a different recipe of these. Some of us have more anger. Some have more attachment. Some have a more tendency towards ignorance. We've all got all of them. Of course we have. So the root delusion is always ignorance. But some people have an expression of that that's particularly powerful. Anger is always the response when attachment doesn't get what it wants. We've all got anger. We've all got attachment, but variations of it. And then we've got the different virtues that temper those delusions. And then maybe some people have some jealousy, but maybe have more arrogance. We're all variations. So we have to know our own mind. The more you know your own mind, that will help you know as you begin to practice Tantra, which we all need all the deities because they're all representations of either the virtues we are trying to cultivate, or they are manifestations of the purified aspect of the delusions that we're trying to get rid of. So in this life, we've all got a certain aspect. I wouldn't call it our core one. Just another word. I would say we've all got a style. Some people are very loud and bossy, you know. Some people are quiet and peaceful nature. Some people are this nature. Some people are that nature. The deities are the idealized version of ourselves. So we will learn to recognize, we'll feel a connection with certain deities based upon knowing our own mind.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much, Robina.
It's marvelous, really, isn't it? It makes a lot of sense.
The reason why I ask is because I'm not into deities, and that's why I want to make sure that if I am to look at any of this, I'd approach it from a correct point.
Absolutely. But in general, you're not into deity. So you mean you don't have confidence in this level of practice? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying I haven't studied it in any way. And that's why I have little familiarity with that, which is why I'm trying to be careful with how I approach it. Yeah.
Totally perfect. Well, then you can always start though by, you know, do you have confidence in the concept of Chenrezig, the manifestation of compassion?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you? I'm asking.
Yes.
You have confidence in, say, the manifestation of this confidence and power, which is called Tara. So then you start with those. Everybody wants those. Everybody needs those. But as we progress at this level, then we get to the highest yoga tantra where we can recognize eventually we can do all of them eventually, because they're all just psychology. They're all just representations, like I said, of minds we're trying to cultivate or purify. And eventually, when we understand and are grounded, just like you're talking, it's so important, then we will begin to feel a connection with certain Buddhas. But we might recognize ourselves. I mean, I thought for years, one particular deity was my Yidam, and then Lama Zopa comes and tells me one completely different. I was totally surprised. So some recognize immediately, and some we have to be told. And then when you're told it, then you can hear that makes sense, you know? Mm-hmm. So each of us is different.
Okay, so that comes slowly. Okay.
One step at a time, darling. Keep it grounded. But your practice, your success at the Vajrayana is dependent upon your success at the Sutrayana. And then your success in Sutrayana prepares you for success in the Vajrayana. So we've got to never forget that.
Thank you so much.
You, Olga, so helpful. Thank you, Olga, so kind.
Thank you, Olga. We've got about 5 minutes left. Does anybody else have any questions for Venerable Robina? Raise your hand or mute yourself.
We can finish and we can have an hour break, and then we can have more questions, and then we can do the meditation and we can just summarize everything. And if any more questions come up, so think of any questions that come up, we can do this in the last 90 minutes.
Okay.
So I'll see you in an hour. Well, hour and 5 minutes. I'll see you in an hour and 5 minutes, okay? Thank you, precious ones.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Such good questions. So helpful. Because they all refer to all of us. It's so clear, isn't it? So thank you, Kim. Thank you, Kelly. Thank you, Malcolm. And thank you, Olya. And thank you, and all of you. Yeah. Thank you, darling. See you later.
Thank you.